As I say, there are lots of stories like that now. And I now think that you can't work with young people, or you can't work with kids in gangs, and you can't work with, I think, most people who are experiencing welfare. You can't work with people who have been defined almost entirely by their deficiencies and emptinesses in any productive way without first starting with their gifts. What are they? Where are they? What do they just love to do? What can they do? So the first tool we always take into public housing when we're invited in to work with groups and resident management and so on is a little interview format called a capacity inventory, which is the opposite of a need survey. Need surveys can be, as far as I'm concerned, burned from here to eternity. There's no need for them. These people on the edge of community have needs. But their primary need is to be connected to community in ways in which they contribute. Not to be diagnosed, not to be treated, not to be filled up, but to be connected in a way that takes advantage of their gift. What better thing for a church to do, right? So let's transition into churches for just a second here. Let me just tell one story and then open it up for some talk here. I was telling Joanne this morning, one of my favorite sanctuaries in the world right now is the sanctuary at 12th Street Baptist Church in Detroit. Pretty devastated neighborhood. Lots of burned out stuff from the Detroit riots that have never been rebuilt. But the pastor there is a wonderful, smart, he's a wonderful theologian as well as a smart community builder. Yeah, named Lee Earle. And what Reverend Earle has done, and we've been talking with him about this stuff for years, is he has made his church into a place where gifts are given. And the way he's done that, is he got his 50 ministers. They're all, you know, anytime somebody comes to a good Baptist minister and says, "I want to do this, Pastor," the smart Baptist anoints them immediately and says, "That's right, you do that and you're a minister." We'll have a big service about that. I mean, I think there's a lot to learn from that, I think, right? He had his 50 ministers go out and do 10 gift interviews each of people both in the parish and in the immediate neighborhood. Short interviews that were about trying to surface what skills people had, what they loved to do, what they were, sort of gifts of the, one way we divide it, gifts of the head, gifts of the heart, and gifts of the body. What are those gifts? And they made lists for each person. And then they gave the lists to the young people in the congregation who got together with a couple of neighborhood artists. And they made 500 colorful banners with symbols on them that had the name of the person and the person's top 3 or 4 or 5 gifts, right? And then they hung them up around the sanctuary so that you walk into 12th Street Baptist Church now and you are surrounded with the immense, deep, wide, broad gifts of the people. And even though outside is total devastation, you recognize that in that place, the feeling is that nothing is impossible. The feeling is, if you start looking at everything everybody can do up there, that you can do it here, right? And therefore, it's a lot easier to get people to do the 12 different enterprises that Lee Earle has going at that church, and the 15 and 20 different kinds of things that he's got going on with young people in the neighborhood. It's a different feeling. And I think churches are uniquely placed in the middle of particularly devastated communities, but maybe ones that aren't so devastated too, to be places where the valued gifts of the people get brought together and gathered, celebrated, and then mobilized. And what that mobilization looks like maybe is something we want to talk about too. But let me stop now and see whether you want to either interact with any of that stuff or add some stuff of your own. We can take it further if you want to. Yeah?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
For people who have lived in devastated areas, sometimes, I I've worked with people coming in the welfare system for a couple of years. Sometimes it seems like they themselves have trouble identifying any gift. What's the skill of helping them to recognize that they have a gift?
Yeah. We talked the other day about this needs map. And one of the things that's absolutely clear to me now is that this is not a map that people, for instance, on welfare or in the South Bronx drew about themselves, right? This is a map that other people drew about them. But that the most tragic thing about the map may be that folks in the South Bronx start believing it's true about themselves, right? And then you do have a problem. The one thing I know is that folks are going to listen to their family and their neighbors before they're going to listen to you or me. So I think part of the trick is to figure out who in the neighborhood, and there's always lots of them, haven't bought this. Mm-hmm. Who's not on board with this idea about who they are. And then to begin to strategize with those folks about how it is that they, for instance, could be doing the capacity inventory from door to door. We don't do that ourselves in public housing, but once you get a group of mothers in public housing who have said, we're going to be a resident management council, we're going to manage this public housing building, right, for this development. Once they've said that, they're ready for tools, right? They're ready to go forth and to figure out how to relate to their neighbors in different kinds of ways. So the mobilizers, it seems to me, are the Rositas, right? The local geniuses who can only look at their neighbors and see the gifts. Yeah, all right. Yeah.
I was just thinking that you said earlier that these folks aren't so different than us.
Right.
And I think there are a lot, at least I can speak for me, that I don't recognize my own gifts either. And other people have had to point out my gifts to me.
I think that's a great
and
point.
And you begin to believe it.
Yeah, you know.
I think that's a good point. And I don't think most churches, whether no matter where they are, whether they're in the suburbs or whether they're in the inner city or in the small towns or rural areas, are terrifically good at recognizing, affirming, celebrating, and then mobilizing the gifts of their members.
I think most of us in ministry, what I observe, are trained to look at needs.
Absolutely. Addicted to them, you are. Yes, we are.
Most of the people, it doesn't do any good because needs are insatiable.
Yes.
But to get churches away from looking at needs, it takes about 2 years in my experience, because they love to focus on the needs that are never going to get fulfilled.
Yeah.
So they feel bad about themselves. But if you get onto this gift thing, I don't know, one church just went out in so many words and had a weekend of everybody telling each other what they thought the gifts were.
Yes, wonderful.
And then it just went on from there.
Yeah.
But I think that's so important, what you're saying.
Yeah. It changes the entire sort of direction of the conversation. And then all of a sudden it's about possibilities, and it's about agendas, and it's about planning, and it's about vision. And it's not about
Right.
No,
in my current congregation.
And it's not about victimization,
right? Well, that's it. In my current congregation, they said, well, we're going to run out of money. I said, I don't think I'm going to run out of money with 6 millionaires in the congregation.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Right.
You just don't.
Yes.
But that's the mentality that they have because of this needs focus. And I think it's been much of our society, I guess, is geared towards needs, isn't it? In terms of interpreting society.
Oh, I think that's right. And entire, obviously, professions and huge institutional and systemic structures have been built around the idea that what a modern society is about is the continuous identification at an individual and personal level of ever increasing numbers of needs,
right,
which can only be met by professionalized systems, so that we no longer have any control over how, whether, and what our children learn, right? We turn them over to places that are run by professionals called schools. We can't think about the possibility that the safety of our community is in our hands because we turn that over to uniformed and armed people called police. We can't possibly take control of our own health as a community or as a family, or as families or individuals, because that's a professionalized set of helping expertise that we turn to all the time. The problem with that, there are numbers of problems with that. Not only does it create ever-increasing incapacity at one end and narrow capacity at the professional end, it doesn't do much good for the helpers either, I don't think, right? But the other thing it does, it's clear, is that it milks all of the available resources, right? You simply can't pay for ever-expanding helping and service professionals. It's just not in the economics of the thing. We can go into that in great detail. And I think that one of the major openings we're having at this point is that people are being forced back into a full recognition of their own capacities at the community level, because the institutions which have purported to do something are running out of resources to do it. Right? So, I mean, on the one hand, that's causing huge disruption and a lot of hardship. On the other hand, it seems to me an incredible opportunity to reclaim some space for people's competencies, for ordinary people's gifts and capacities to take care of each other. And churches could have a key role in that.
I just wanted to tell you about a story that was in the paper. It isn't someone I knew, but it happened in Portland. There was apparently in a neighborhood in northeast Portland, which is not, some areas in northeast Portland are not too nice, but there was a man they called the weatherman, and he was apparently retarded, but he greeted everybody on the street and told them what the weather was going to be today. And he was like the one fellow you were talking about. And there was a drive-by shooting and he was killed, and they had a huge funeral because all the people in the neighborhood knew the weatherman, and he was their official greeter.
Mm-hmm. Somebody sent me an article about that, I think.
Really?
Yeah, it was a wonderful and loving obituary by somebody in the neighborhood about this fellow and what he had given to the neighborhood. And it struck me because, as you're saying, it was a view of somebody who would be ordinarily thought of as nothing but a problem, as a really important center to a community. I thought it was a wonderful obituary. Interesting story. Let me say just a brief word then about, I do think that there's all kinds of senses in which churches are, or at least in cities, are waking up to these sets of possibilities. The three kinds of roles, it seems to me, obviously beyond word and sacrament and beyond the sort of core of what a church and what working out the faith in a local congregation is about. The three sort of things reaching into community, it seems to me, that churches are up to these days, all of which are booming and blooming in very interesting and unpredicted ways. The first has to do with the rebirth over the last 8 or 10 years of church-based community organizing in cities. Now, there are probably 150 cities in the United States that have extensive networks of community organizations that are now based exclusively on churches. And how many of you are familiar with that movement at all? Thinking about the church in this sense as a power organization, as a place where citizens come together and where they could, within their faith commitment, but within their commitment as citizens as well, be organized into forces which could begin to shape policy, particularly with reference to their neighborhoods. That's going on all over. There are three major networks of church-based community organizations, that is national or extensive regional networks, one the Industrial Areas Foundation out of New York, one the Gamaliel Foundation out of Chicago, and one PICO, the Pacific Institute for Community Organizing, out of San Diego. Each of those has dozens of cities where the churches have been brought together to formulate agendas, to shape issues, and then to knock on the doors, sometimes forcefully, of the political leaders and sometimes the economic leaders in neighborhoods. It goes back to the old Saul Alinsky tradition, but it is the new thing about it is that all of the most powerful forms of organizing are now church-based. And that wasn't the case as near ago as a decade. The second thing that you have more and more and more congregations and cities engaged in is community economic development. I mentioned the other day that one of the great untold economic stories of the last 12 years is that virtually all of the low-income housing that's been built in the United States, 600,000 units of it, has been built by community development corporations, at least half of which have churches as key players in what it is they're doing. And there's an increasing sophistication. The Lutherans are not quite as heavily involved in this as they might be, but there are lots of instances where they are. Increasing sophistication about how, when the entire economic rug is pulled from out from under a community, how it is you start rebuilding it. what it is that you begin putting together that creates jobs and creates housing for people at the local level. And an incredibly exciting story that is just now beginning to be, I think, visible to people. And the third thing, it seems to me, that churches are doing across the country has to do with these little stories that I've been telling you about community building. Thinking how it is the church, the parish, the local congregation, could be at the center of a set of relationships not only with the individuals in the community, the leaders and the strangers both, but also with all of the other institutions and associations of the community. So it's not, a church is no longer, particularly in a city, in a position where it can afford to be isolated. It just has to be in relationship with everything else in that area, right, Carol? Yeah. Clearly, you can't separate yourself out anymore. And I think the church brings some special gifts to those relationships. It brings some gifts about the importance of and value of grace alongside the law, if you will. The importance and value of ritual and celebration in community. The importance and value of valuing the strangers and the weakest among us. All of those, it seems to me, are perspectives that community building badly needs, that the church, if it would uncover it, has probably more strongly than any other institution in local communities, and which increasingly the church is giving. So those three things, community organizing, community economic development, community building, I'm sort of calling this third one, seem to me to be growing and by leaps and bounds, and more stories are available weekly.
Yes. What do you figure, I would say, the population of this area in Chicago, 60,000, how many of them are churched versus unchurched?
Logan Square, probably in the 20% of that community that's still Eastern European and Polish, probably all of them are connected with a Catholic parish in some way or other. How seriously is another question. In the Latino part of the community, the Puerto Rican community, some are Catholic, many are evangelical, and probably 50% are unchurched. In the African American community, probably 60 or 70% are churched. So it's still church, there's a huge variation in what church means.
Some kind of connection.
Connection in some way.
Has that changed in the period you talked about with the new group?
Yeah, it has a lot, because the populations have changed a lot. That community is a community that was for the last 100 years has been mainly Eastern European, right? So that it's dotted with huge Catholic churches, many of which now are apostolic or, Church of God in Christ or some evangelical sect that came from the island, Puerto Rico. So the church has always been at the center of that community, but what the church is and in relationship to whom has changed a lot. There are still four Lutheran congregations in that neighborhood, and none of them is anything like what they were 40 years ago, right? Two of them think they still could be, and they're pretty isolated. But the other two are pretty interesting because they're struggling, and like a lot of other mainline denominations, once you begin to open the doors to the neighborhood, not only does your own church life change a lot, but you begin to be able to attract from a whole range of different groupings, I mean, nobody in that neighborhood knows anyone what a Lutheran is. So if by some chance they sort of get to the church,
right,
and they think that this is some place that could be home, then they bring something with them, and all of a sudden you've got a, you know, in some mainline denominations and in one of the Lutheran churches in Market Square, there's a nice mix of folks. So the church is very different.
So how does this relate with the typical governmental dispenser of services? Could you repeat the question? I'm just wondering what this relationship of the church is there in community with the general municipality government and the Christian awareness or the, anti-religion, anti-Christian attitude in the secular.
I think there's renewed interest in the church as an institution for secular community building.
Yeah.
Among government people who are more sophisticated, among foundation folks, for example, I think they're willing to look at the church in a slightly different way, which really makes some opportunities, I think, for
I think that's coming. I sense that there maybe is a beginning of a turning about that. It seems to me that up until just recently, though, it's been pretty pretty anti-church out there, and it's sort of looked upon as being, if not stupid, at least weird. And I don't think the press has been very good about that, but I think there's a sense in which that's changing a bit.
I think
in Los Angeles, I see that.
Yeah.
For instance, the AME Church, the big one in Los Angeles, has got a lot of
the center of that whole rebuilding kind of process.
I was thinking, I thought of a funny story that my little church on the west side, strangely enough, got involved in, not through any, just through the sheer luck of my happening finally to read the church newsletter for like 2 months before that time. I got around to read it, but there was some local church had gotten brand new choir gowns. Big church, not, and so they decided that we should be the recipient of their old choir gowns. my little congregation has a choir of about between 8 and 10, and the last thing they wanted was choir gowns because they hated the ones they had before, and these were even worse. They were sort of light blue and feminine looking and all that kind of thing. And so they didn't want to wear them, and there were about 80 of these things. And, it's this huge box full of choir gowns. And so I finally got around to reading the newsletter two months earlier, and here was an advertisement wanted in our newsletter from not the AME Church, but a big missionary Baptist church downtown Los Angeles. And they were looking for choir gowns, and they wanted, if possible, to have 40 to 60 of the same type. Well, so I called up this guy. here the congregation is arguing about whether, you could have a choir that doesn't wear gowns. And my choir decided that the people that didn't sing in the choir wanted gowns, and the choir didn't want gowns. So we said, do you want a choir or don't you? We're not going to wear gowns. Anyway, so I call out this guy as the potential solver of my problems. I got really stupid gowns. Well, what he was going to, and I just in talking to him, I said, I hope I'm not too late, but I've got a gift for you, about 80 gowns. And he was ecstatic. Because what he wanted it for was they were going to create a community choir for homeless.
That's interesting.
And the whole point was that their clothing was so bad that they could just cover it up on Sunday.
Sure.
That would legitimize their appearance as a choir. I thought, oh, great. The only one that really appreciated this wonderful gift that we gave, and they said, oh good, you got rid of those.
Well, the model is we better use everything we've got. I know a staff meeting is about to happen in here, so we better call this to a halt at this point. Thank you all.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
Changes.
Were you all in the staff meeting?
He's taking that myself.
If you want to.
Yes.
Thanks
very much.
You got to get more people involved with the right color. Welcome to another Holden Village tape of an important discussion and lecture. This is Jody Kretzman, and he's talking about rebuilding our cities, what churches are doing. So now let's go to the fireside room for Jody to begin.
Are we everybody in and dry, more or less? Say hello to the Tape Ministry. Hi, Tape Ministry. Might as well get going. My name is Jody Kretzman, and this is a session on rebuilding our cities, what churches can do and are doing. We've been having a discussion in the last over the last week or so about rebuilding cities and some of the things that seem to be bubbling up out of the grassroots in cities across the country. And we've been trying to think about ways in which the seeds for rebuilding cities are being sown in some of the most unlikely places. And what I want to get around to this evening is to talk with you about, and to, I hope, gather some more stories about what it is churches can do, are doing, in cities across the country that contribute to what may be a kind of one of these days critical mass of activity in terms of rebuilding cities. Before turning to the churches, let me just do a... How many folks were around for our discussion a couple of days ago? A number of you were, anyway. Let me just spend a moment reviewing the framework that we're working out of here and a little bit of the story that that brings me to this discussion at this point. I've been working in cities headquartered out of Chicago, but lots of other cities as well over the last nearly 30 years. And for the last 5 years, we've had the immense privilege of having the resources to go around to the 25 largest cities in the United States and visit with people in the most devastated neighborhoods in those cities. And as I said the other night, what we've been doing then is to collect from those people in the South Bronxes and in the west side of Chicago and in public housing across the United States and in South Central Los Angeles, collecting from folks in those cities stories that are not about their problems and their immense, immense challenges, but stories about their successes, what's been working, what is it that people have put together in the face of incredibly difficult circumstances that begins to embody a sense of possibility and hope for those communities. And we've collected hundreds of those stories, and lots of them are collected in a book that we put out a couple months ago called Building Communities from the Inside Out, more copies of which than this I don't have, but I do have order forms for it. Ran out of the first printing already, faster than we thought. So that's sort of the background that I want to speak from. And just to say a word about what seems to me to be probably the major lesson when you listen to people who are against impossible odds building
hundreds and thousands of units of housing, employing thousands of people in places where all the jobs had left, building churches into incredibly thriving congregations in very barren and unpromising demographic territory, right? What all of those people, I think now, have in common is that they have rejected the normal view of what they and their communities are all about. And we spent a lot of time thinking about that in the last session, so let me just summarize it. The normal view, it seems to me, of the South Bronxes and the South Central Los Angeleses and the public housing developments of our country is a view that has grown up without much thought over the last probably 35 years, intensified in the Great Society days, that has begun to, it seems to us, reach the end of its utility. And the view is simply that there's something different about the poor, that they're not like you and me. And the way they're not like you and me is that they are entirely a bundle of needs and problems and deficiencies. And that their neighborhoods, too, are at the most important level, collections of emptinesses, endless problems. So that we play with this set of images. This is titled the Neighborhood Needs Map. And it's what you could get if you thought about the South Bronx and you said, what do I think about when I think about the South Bronx? Isn't this it? It's about broken families and slum housing and crime and gangs and welfare recipients and dropouts and illiteracy and truancy and unemployment and on and on. We could add another 30 or 40. The problem with this is that it's unremittingly oriented toward the emptiness of the communities and the people who live in them. And it denies what we all know about communities. Which is that they can only be built on the basis of people's fullnesses, their gifts, what it is they have to contribute. Yet we've constructed walls around whole cities, in fact, which have trapped people in an idea that they don't have anything, and that therefore all of their help is from the outside. And then we have constructed huge, mega-billion, dollar institutions built on this set of ideas that we who are credentialed and professionalized have the only possible answers for people who are in need in cities. We could talk some more about that if those of you who haven't talked to me about that want to. But what I've been suggesting is that in the hundreds of stories we've been gathering, including those that come from churches, about successes in impossible situations. One of the things they all have in common is that they have thrown out that set of ideas about who they are. And they have said, that may be true, all of those problems are here in the South Bronx. But it's not the whole truth about us. Who we are in the South Bronx or in South Central Los Angeles is also an incredibly varied and talented, rich, if you will, group of individuals and families, which if we brought ourselves to the point of solving problems together, could take us a long way down the path toward rebuilding communities.
I have one question.
Yes.
That's real important. Now, the inner city, it's going to be a perpetual problem if we have landlords that own the biggest percentage
right.
of the city.
Right.
It's going to be perpetual. Now, what is the situation? Is it private ownership, or is it big landowners owning large blocks of land in the city?
It varies from neighborhood to neighborhood. Some neighborhoods that are near downtowns now, as downtowns have rejuvenated over the last 20 years in some of our older cities, those neighborhoods begin to be much more valuable real estate than they were for a while. And when that happens, people begin buying it up again. And there's a struggle there about who's going to control and get the benefits of that new wealth being created by the land. other low-income neighborhoods, though their decline can be explained, I think this is the discussion you and I were having the other day, their decline can be explained in large part by the fact that people who used to live there and own there then moved, and new people came in, new people with not quite as many resources, crowded up, and a lot of landlords no longer had a stake in that neighborhood. They were elsewhere, and they allowed those buildings to deteriorate. So in neighborhood after neighborhood, you had the phenomenon of the absentee landlord creating housing conditions that just went on a downward spiral. I think that's changed now in most inner city neighborhoods. That's not a dynamic that is quite as lively as it was 20 years ago because the population of cities has leveled off. You don't have cities growing exponentially like you used to. So you've got now neighborhoods where there's an awful lot of abandoned buildings, abandoned land, land is lying useless, rubble, where in fact, if there's an absentee landlord, she or he doesn't care about that land anymore. They've milked it for all they can get, and they now ignore the taxes. So there's a lot of property in inner city America which is lying virtually useless and has no relationship to wealth production at all, which means it's a different situation. You can start thinking then about that land as potentially wealth-producing land. And that's part of what we're going to talk about today. That's part of what churches are up to. When they discard that other map, community leaders across the country, including church folks, are reconstructing a map that looks something like this. This is a simple depiction that sort of recognizes that every community that has ever been built is built partly on the gifts of individuals, which get mobilized by citizens associations, which is where, at this point in the discussion, we put churches, and which sometimes gets helped by the recaptured power of local institutions, and I might talk a little bit more about that in a session tomorrow. But we wanted to focus on the associations and the individuals. This is all about a process, then, that we've been watching develop in cities, which is not headline stuff. It doesn't get on Brokaw. It's not in the New York Times, except in the back sections once in a while. And it is a process which looks to us now like it has three major characteristics. It's about community building, and community building that is first of all centered on assets rather than on needs. Secondly, because it's centered on assets, it is resolutely focused inside the community so that people in public housing are not looking first to the outside. People in the South Bronx are not first looking to city government or to funders. People in local congregations in cities are not first looking to ELCA headquarters for dollars and support. First, they're looking to each other. So it's internally focused. Asset-based, internally focused, and then thirdly, it is therefore relationship-driven. This is a map that pushes people back together to say, what have we got? How can we connect it for problem-solving purposes? Now, enough abstractions. Let me tell a few stories about this for just a second. One of the things, you'll notice there's some odd categories in this. Let me say a word about these individuals and then go to churches for a second. Elderly, labeled people, youth, income, and artists happen to be what's represented here. One of the reasons that that's such an odd collection of things is that we've started to think about the relationship between communities from here are always circles. There's something about that that's right. By the way, institutions from here are always triangles. Everybody in communities knows that there are people who are leaders. There are people at the center of communities. There are people who are already plugged into the civic life, the economic life of the neighborhood. And most churches, if they're good at all, are pretty good at spotting leaders. And in fact, those of us who did community organizing, Judy, remember that one of the things we were taught to do was to spot the natural leaders. Who, you know, everybody knows on this block, nothing happens unless Mrs. Smith says it does, right? Mrs. Smith doesn't have any office, right? Never elected to anything, but everybody knows she's there. And everybody knows unless you get her on board, nothing's going to happen in that block. That continues to be awfully important work and something that churches are awfully good at doing when they focus on doing that kind of thing. We, however, have become more and more interested in the folks who are out here on the margins of community. and how they got there, what they're doing out there, and whether it's possible to grab them and bring them back inside. I now think that most people who are at the margins of community are there, let me try to summarize this real quickly, are there because they have been captured by an institution which has robbed them from community, and the institution has robbed them on the basis of a diagnosis, and a diagnosis of their emptiness, of their deficiency. So young people are thought to be deficient in knowledge and therefore incapable of contributing to community, and they are therefore grabbed by schools and put away until they can be filled up and then come back in as useful members of community, right? Similar thing, I think, happens with older folks. They are grabbed because their deficiency is their oldness, right? And put aside. So we've been thinking with communities about how you rebuild communities on the gifts of the strangers. We start calling these people strangers rather than the people at the margins. Let me just tell you a quick story because it may make the point more easily, and it's something that churches, I think, have a really wonderful opportunity to participate in. One of the places in neighborhoods in Chicago that we've done a lot of work over the years is a neighborhood called Logan Square. Logan Square is a neighborhood of about 40,000 people that has a population about 60% Puerto Rican, Latino, probably most of that is Puerto Rican, maybe 15 or 20% African American, 15% Eastern European, and another 5 or 10% sort of yuppie. But there's a wonderful organization there called the Logan Square Neighborhood Association that's been there forever, and it comes out of the old Alinsky-style community organizing tradition. And those of you who know that tradition, and I have had my own experience in that and respect it a lot, know that what that tradition does, is to pull together the power in neighborhoods and then figure out how it is that power can be exercised against governments or against private sector players like banks, in order to get them either to stop doing something or to do something different in the neighborhood, right? You did that, Judy, didn't you? Yes. What these folks did, though, was to start a discussion about 5 or 6 years ago about their relationship to the folks in their community. And they were thinking, you know, we know a lot of these people. We know a lot of the people who are leaders in this community, and they all work with us, and we get a lot of stuff done with them. But we don't know these people. They felt like there were an awful lot of people in the neighborhood that they had nothing left to do with. So we started thinking with them about what they might do. And they started out doing a wonderful thing. They started holding meetings in church basements throughout the neighborhood. And the meetings had one agenda item. And the agenda item was, who are the strangers in this neighborhood? List the strangers. Who are the people among us whom we don't know, right? And they made wonderfully interesting lists, you know, and some people said it is the young people. It's particularly the young people in gangs. Some people put older folks on the list. It being the kind of neighborhood it is, some people said the biggest strangers in this community are the police, right? We don't know who they are. They come in here and cause all sorts of strange problems. But there was one set of people who was on, they did about eight of these meetings, and on every list, one group appeared, and it was a group that was severely mentally disabled people who had been in the big state hospitals when Illinois deinstitutionalized, right? And then they had been put out into community residences, those folks who didn't get just back on the streets, right? The lucky ones. Logan Square was a neighborhood that had three of these local halfway houses or residents for developmentally disabled people. And they said, these are people in our community who we know are our neighbors. We know these houses are here, but we have no idea what their names are. We don't know them at all. They have no three-dimensionality or humanity to us. They're not involved in anything we do. So the top of the list of strangers in the community were these folks. Now, they had to figure out what to do about that. And what they did about it was they hired a genius to help them work on it. And the genius was a woman named Rosita De La Rosa. And Rosita was a high school dropout who had grown up in Logan Square. And Rosita had two elements to her genius. One was that she was a person, is a person, who can never look at another human being without first seeing that human being's gifts, without first seeing the fullness. She doesn't care much about your problems. She does. But she cares about your problems because first she sees what you've got, right? So she's just a genius in that way. And her second point of genius was that she knew everybody in the neighborhood. And everybody knew her, and everybody trusted her. She had a pretty good relationship. So they put Rosita to work. And what Rosita did was she went into the halfway houses and simply began meeting people. And what she was doing was she was trying to identify their gifts. And at the same time, she was having a second series of conversations with people in the community. Friends, people in businesses, people at the police station, parks leaders, libraries leaders, certainly church leaders. And she began thinking about matching the gifts of her friends to places in the neighborhood which could call forth those gifts, right? There are now more than 50 stories like this, but let me tell you two quick ones. Rosita found a 65-year-old Polish guy named Frank, who, as far as anybody knew, never spoke, right? Was absolutely silent. He was in one of these homes. And Rosita began visiting Frank, and the first time she visited for about half an hour, chatted amiably, and not much response from Frank. But she came back a few days later and visited again, not too much response from Frank, but it was perfectly cordial. And the third time Rosita came to visit Frank, they chatted for a few minutes, and then Frank took Rosita's hand and led her back to the back of the house, big old rambling house, to his room. And so Rosita followed and went. Frank, when they got there, Frank said, didn't say anything, this word pointed to the bed where Rosita was to sit. And they sat there for a minute, and Rosita was trying to think about what to do in the situation. And as she describes it, the room was dark, there were no windows, it was bare. It was not a place where there was a sort of full-dimensional human life going on at all. Until her eyes lit on the top of the dresser, where there was one object which was clearly the center of the room, because it was polished, clearly well cared for, it sat on a pedestal, and it was a bowling ball. And so Rosita, genius as she is, asked Frank the one question that in decades of being cared for by PhD psychologists and counselors and helpers, nobody ever asked him. And she said, Frank, do you like to bowl? And Frank just lit up, smiled from ear to ear, didn't say anything, just grinned, went over to the dresser, got the bowling ball down, gave it to Rosita, put her hands on it, had her sort of stroke the bowling ball, put her fingers in the bowling ball holes. Right? So clearly Rosita had it, right? Frank's gift was that he liked the bowl. She knew now. And once Rosita knows, she's off and running. She zips over to her cousin, who is the captain of a bowling team in the local Puerto Rican Bowling League, and says, do you have room on your team? Or, I have a new friend who really likes to bowl. Do you have room on your team for anybody? He said, no, we're filled up. The season's just started. We've got six people. That's all we need. She was persistent, and finally, they all sort of think Rosita's a little nutty. He said, fine, send the guy along on Wednesday nights. He can come, and he can at least, bowl with us. We don't have to count his score. So Frank became the seventh member of a six-member Puerto Rican bowling team. And for the first couple of times out, all of his balls were gutter balls. He clearly hadn't bowled in decades, right? But then slowly the balls began staying in the lane, and he'd be knocking down a few pins. And after a little while, they began keeping score, and he had a little bit of a handicap. After about 6 months, one of the regular members of the team left to go someplace else, and Frank got invited on to the team as a regular member of the team. In the meantime, Frank had begun visiting the team members' homes, getting to know their families and their kids, and beginning to relate as a sort of grandfather even to some of the kids. by the end of the first year, he was a full-fledged member of that bowling team. And by the end of the second year, the team won the league championship with Frank as a member of the team. And then at the end of the third, this last year was just the fourth year of this event. At the end of the third year, at the annual banquet of the Puerto Rican Bowling League, Frank was named Bowler of the Year. huge trophy.
Oh.
After the first eight months, just at the end of the first season of this, Frank, for the first time in anybody's memory, began speaking. And when he began speaking, though, he did not speak either Polish, which is his first language, or English, his second. He spoke Spanish. That's all he had heard. So he came back to life as a Spanish-speaking 66-year-old Polish person. So as Frank is coming back to life, and as the families gather a new grandfather, the Puerto Rican Bowling League begins to look at this and think about what had happened here. And they begin saying, well, we might begin to think of ourselves differently here at the Puerto Rican Bowling League. We could be, in fact, a place where kids on the street could come and could learn to bowl and learn what we love to do. And we could have a league for kids. And then we could have an intergenerational league. And then we could have a family kind of league. And we certainly ought to, there are probably more people like Frank out there. We could have leagues that involve older folks in the community in bowling. So all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but over a three-year period, the Puerto Rican Bowling League rethinks who it is. And all of a sudden, it is now the sort of center of hospitality for the Logan Square neighborhood. Do you see what's happened here? See, nobody ever said, what's wrong with Frank? Tell us the diagnosis so we can treat Frank. Instead, they said, Rosita said, what's your gift? And where do you connect it in community, in a place that it can be given? So community gets defined as that place where individuals' gifts are valued and given. And community gets built by the giving of those gifts. One other story from that Logan Square work. Rosita also found a guy named Ed, who is a guy now in his mid-30s, then in his early 30s, whose gift was not as difficult to spot as was Frank's. Because Ed was somebody who would go through life always smiling from ear to ear, talking to everybody, at the top of his voice, in sentences that went on and on, and often didn't make a whole lot of sense, clapping people on the back, grinning at them, absolutely spreading joy. Sometimes overwhelmingly, beyond where people wanted to be spread. But Rosita looked at Ed and said, I understand now what your gift is, you are a happy person. And she went to a high school classmate, as it turned out, of hers, who was head of nursing at Norwegian American Hospital, the local hospital. The last Norwegian left this neighborhood 80 years ago. Norwegian American Hospital is still there. And she said to her friend who was head of nursing, I have a happy friend and you have a sad place. She said, I come around this hospital and I never see anybody smiling. Your doctors look sad, your nurses look sad, patients look sad. I said, do you have any room at your sad place for a happy friend? Her classmate also thought that Rosita was a little nuts, but she said, look, I'll take you to talk to the hospital administrator. So what happened is that they gave Ed a job. What Ed does now is his. He comes to the hospital in the morning, and there's a supermarket basket there that is stacked with the interdepartmental mail for that, right? So the hospital has 11 departments, oncology and OBGYN and so forth. And Ed's job is to deliver the mail. Now, so he started doing that, but an immediate problem was that Ed can't read. So that, not a whole lot of mail was going to the right department. But because Ed would sort of spread joy as he was misdelivering the mail, nobody was... They would get on the phone and sort of, I have your mail today, oncology, you have mine. They'd exchange it in that way. they got a little better, they worked on it for a while, and they got a color coding system, so that now there's a bundle of mail that's dotted red, and that goes to oncology and so on, right? But still, there's about 20% of it every day that gets misdelivered, and nobody much cares. And we went in about 6 months after Ed started to work there to talk to the hospital administrator, just to talk with him about what was happening here, what his view of Ed's work at the hospital was. And he was glad to talk. And he said, "Jody, let me tell you two things about Ed and his work at this hospital." He said, "Number one, I've been the hospital administrator at Norwegian American Hospital for about 10 years now. And every year since I've been administrator, we've had a hospital-wide retreat. And then within that, we've had a manager's retreat, sort of the top 30 managers of the hospital. And our major agenda item at that annual retreat, never gone away, never been able to solve it, was interdepartmental communication. None of the departments in this hospital ever talked to each other." He said, "Since Ed has been here, Mr. Mail, everybody all of a sudden knows each other, and they're talking to each other constantly."